Hey, I'm Brooke. My friends and I perform spooky stories on our podcast, 13. 13 is a movie for your ears with immersive sound design and music from our composer. And we're not reading you the same old ghost stories from Reddit. With original stories from our in-house writers and submissions from up-and-coming authors, 13 will make you smile, break your heart, and have you wishing for a nightlight. Atmospheric, slow burn, always spooky, and sometimes sexy. Our friends are some of the best voice actors and writers in our little corner of the podcast industry. So if you want to find out why those figures in black keep meeting by the water just before dawn, why you should never sleep in a room with an empty chair, or why you hear faint music echoing from the abandoned mall, join us by following 13 wherever you're listening right now. That's 13, the word, not the number, all spelled out.
Bridget Howard keeps asking for my teeth.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
We couldn't be more excited to announce that the 1st and 2nd of February 2025 are the dates for the upcoming Deep Dive virtual retreat, which has reverted back to a weekend format so that we can accommodate as many of our listeners across the world as possible. Now, if you love the breakout room sessions and workshops from this year's 10-week Deep Dive, don't worry. We'll still be including sessions like those before and after the two-day intensive. Plus, this year we're focusing on giving you access to more gatekeepers. So, besides a few awesome author presentations, expect to hear from a lot more incredible agents and editors. This lineup is spectacular. We can't wait to start sharing it with you. Mark the dates in your calendar, especially the date for the early bird pricing, which will happen on the 29th of November. You definitely don't want to miss that. Follow us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter for more details. We hope to see you there.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a three-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is the Hugo Award-winning author of The 10,000 Doors of January, The Once and Future Witches, and various short fiction, including the Fractured Fables novellas. A former academic adjunct and Kentuckian, she now lives in Virginia with her husband and their two semi-feral kids. It's my pleasure to welcome Alex E. Harrow. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to get to chat with you. It's not often that we get to dive into gothic fantasy. It's an awesome genre for us to discuss today. So before we dive into the interview, I'm just going to read the flat copy to our readers so that they have some context. Of the novel that we're discussing today is called Starling House. It was a Reese's Book Club pick, and it's coming out now in paperback. So Opal is a lot of things: orphan, high school dropout, full-time cynic, and part-time cashier, but above all, she's determined to find a better life for her younger brother, Jasper, one that gets them out of Eden, Kentucky, a town remarkable for only two things: bad luck and E. Starling, the reclusive 19th century author of The Underland, who disappeared over 100 years ago. All she left behind were dark rumors and her home. Everyone agrees that it's best to ignore the uncanny mansion and its misanthropic heir, Arthur. Almost everyone, anyway. Opal has been obsessed with the Underland since she was a child. When she gets the chance to step outside Starling House and make some extra cash for her brother's escape fund, she can't resist. but sinister forces are digging deeper into the buried secrets of Starling House, and Arthur's own nightmares have become far too real. As Eden itself seems to be drowning in its own ghosts, Opal realizes she might finally have found a reason to stick around, and now she'll have to fight. Welcome to Starling House. Enter if you dare. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, so all the creepy gothic vibes, absolutely loved it. Before we discuss the book, Alex, our listeners love hearing about different journeys to publication in terms of from when you started writing, how you got your agent, how the journey has been to the point that you got told you were a Reese's Book Club pick.
There's a lot of steps in there. It's narratives are always about what you put in and what you don't, right? So the honest truth is that I wrote my first book, and I'm doing air quotes, you know, in middle school, like many of us did. And it was terrible. It was basically Tamora Pierce fan fiction. And then I got teenagehood struck, and I got very serious, and I wanted to be taken seriously. And so I didn't write and read fantasy anymore. And I got my history degree. And then when that didn't employ me, I got another history degree just in case, you know, as one does. And it was only when I was adjuncting, I kind of came back to it. And I was like, what if I actually tried, though? What if as an adult, I actually tried? And so I started writing some short stories and my first novel. And then this is the part where my agent told me if I ever wanted to have writing friends, I should never tell this story at conferences, which is true. She's right. So I had a short story come out, and it went around the very small bubble of like sci-fi and fantasy Twitter. And then I got a DM from an editor and a DM from an agent that was like, hey, do you have a novel by any chance? And I was like, I do. Here it is. I was about to write a query letter. And then that was my editor, and that's still my agent. So it all kind of spiraled from there. And the reason I do tell the story, even though it doesn't win new friends, is to emphasize how much of publishing, yes, you do the work. You know, you write, you do all these things, but it's a lot of luck. It really, really is. And good timing and good fortune. And I never want to discount that.
Yeah, there are people out there who are going to be like, damn you, Alex, it's been too easy for you. But what I love about this is that it was a short story that you put out there that grabbed people's attention. Because, you know, we get told as fiction writers, stay in your lane, write novels. You know, if that's what you're doing, write novels. But you never know what you're going to write that is going to grab people's attention. And, you know, that was the one thing you did. And without that being out there, you know, you probably would have gotten your agent way down the line, but it wouldn't have happened the way it did.
Yeah. And I do think the only actual things, of course, you can control in publishing is your craft, right? And the reason I was writing short stories is because I was very sure, and I was right, that I didn't know what I was doing yet, because I didn't have, you know, writing degrees or classes or workshops. I didn't have the experience that I needed. And so I was writing short stories specifically to get better at craft and to practice. And like without that practice and attention to art, you don't actually get to do the fun opportunity things.
Can we speak a bit about your novellas as well? Because generally that's really tough for authors to get published, writing novellas. You know, we've got agents on the podcast and they generally say, oh, anything shorter than this is so difficult to get published. And obviously short stories or an anthology of short stories is so difficult to get published. So how did you manage that?
Oh, so this is a very genre specific scenario, right? So sci-fi and fantasy, I think, to my knowledge, it's one of the only existing genres where you can have professional paying fiction at almost any length. So there's flash fiction markets, which is under 1,000 words. There's short stories. And then there's increasingly a novella market, not just with Tor.com, but I think there's some other houses that are doing shorter sci-fi and fantasy. And I do think there's kind of an old history of novellas in the sci-fi space in particular, but they've done a really, really good job with them. Like they're marketing them, they're in bookstores, you know, indies and Barnes & Noble and things like that. And what I think is fantastic about that is that every artistic idea that you have is not automatically necessarily in the 90,000, 250,000 word range. That's just not how ideas work. And I love the freedom of genre spaces where the scale of your project, you can kind of fit it to whatever it needs to be. You know, if it's an epic space trilogy or whatever, you can have lots of books. That's not to say that the market doesn't contract at either end, right? A very short novella or like anything longer than a trilogy is a harder sell today than maybe it used to be, but it's there.
Yeah, and it's interesting in a space as well because fantasy and science fiction is the one genre where you can go to the longer side. in terms of word count. You know, generally we say if you are doing genre fiction that is a thriller or romance, you need to hit the sweet spot of about 80,000 words. But when it comes to science fiction and fantasy, because of the world building, you can have a much longer word length. And so it's interesting that in the same genre, you can also have much shorter word length.
I mean, I personally think that that would work in every, I don't think it's something magical and special about those genres. It's just sort of the publishing industry that has arisen around them. Like, I would love to read a 200,000 word romance novel. Like, please, I'm the audience for that. But there's not really a generated market for that yet.
Yeah, I like that you said yet. So that could change as well. So just to kick us off here, in terms of the world building for this novel was huge, because not only did you have to come up with the town of Eden in terms of its commerce, in terms of its 100-year-old, well, much longer than 100-year-old history, but, you know, there's a lot of players in this town, the industry, etc. But then you also had to come up with a book within a book kind of thing. So that was a lot of work. So can you take us through your process there? Did you have to do all of that contextualized sort of backstory in terms of the world building before you could begin writing the novel? Or was it, damn it, I'm going right in, and as I need to figure this shit out, I'll figure it out as I'm going along?
I've never once been like, oh, I'm going right in. I just don't have that kind of nerve. But of course, you do end up figuring out much of the world building as you're drafting. I just need to pretend that I'm not. I need to have a plan to grasp. But actually, a lot of that world building that you're talking about in particular was not something that I had to spend a lot of time inventing, because I'm from Western Kentucky. So that's just remixed versions of real things, many of them actual family stories that I've used for this. So like, I do that a lot with my world building. It's kind of cheating. It's taking very real things that I know, either from like my history degrees or from my family, and just turning them like 60 degrees, you know, so they're not exactly right. But so like the town of Eden, Kentucky is based on the actual town of Paradise, Kentucky. You see how clever I am. Which is very near where I grew up, and which is the subject of the famous John Prine song. And has a very specific sort of Western Kentucky coal mining history that I was kind of building everything on.
That is not cheating at all. You know, I feel like there's an authenticity that you bring to world building when it is based on real life, on real history, etc. So you're tweaking the details, but you're keeping the specificity. And it's in the specifics that a story feels authentic and that it really comes alive. And so definitely not cheating at all. In terms of the story within the story, how did that evolve in terms of coming up with that and knowing, you know, what that story was, how Opal responded to it, why it captured her imagination, and again, the person who wrote that story originally?
So I've done this before. I've done a couple of books within a book. I don't know why I have to do this, except that I think that as a person who processes much of my own like life and emotion and understanding the world through fiction, of course, I am always handing my protagonists a piece of formative fiction that will help them process their world. In this case, I was actually thinking about my own kids quite a bit. They are now 6 and 8, but they were younger when I was writing. And I was fascinated by the kinds of stories and books that they were falling in love with, which I remembered falling in love with, and which are not always what you're handing them. They love weird stuff and dark stuff and surprisingly eerie things. Like, it just kind of obsesses them. Like, both my kids were going through such an intense, they still are, like, Greek and Egyptian mythology phase. And I think in part that's because those stories go very hard, like much harder than children's fiction is allowed to. You know, you have betrayals and beheadings and just all this gruesome and intense stuff, and they're obsessed with it. And so I was thinking about that inherent part of children, and I was thinking about things like Victorian and Edwardian era culture, which was so obsessed with handing morals to readers and particularly to children, how that didn't stick, right? The fiction that really grips people is often much darker and stranger and more obscure in terms of its messaging. And so I was thinking, probably because we're going through kind of another puritanical bent in culture right now, I was thinking about the kinds of fiction that survives that and how dark and strange it is. And so I came up with like a gothic children's picture book that obsesses my main character.
Yeah, with these dark illustrations that are quite psychologically jarring and stark, and loved imagining those as well. They were very visceral. Something you've did really, really well with Opal is you've given us a sort of prickly character. You know, she is hard edges on the outside, but a big smile on the face. There's this always this smile and this chirpy veneer, but the inside of her, in terms of her interiority, contradicts that so much, which we love, because that immediately creates a tension with how the character presents themselves to how we know they are. But also, Jasper was genius in terms of not only did he soften her, because the minute we have a prickly character who loves someone so much that they will sacrifice everything for them, that immediately makes them vulnerable and it immediately gets us on board with them. But it creates these kind of high stakes in terms of her wants and needs. So can you speak a bit about having a secondary character? Because we don't get Jasper's point of view unless it's through sort of Opal, but how a secondary character can up the stakes of the story and make the main character more accessible.
So that's discussing it in very clear craft terms, which I can only see maybe after the draft is done. Because ultimately, like, I think a lot of us are writing from actually very emotional and personal places. This book is dedicated to both of my little brothers. So I was not thinking as I invented the character of Opal, wow, she's kind of a bitch. Am I allowed to swear? Okay. I wasn't
thinking. The podcast is called The Shit No One Tells You About.
That's right.
It's in the name.
I wasn't thinking, wow, she's kind of a bitch, I better give her something that makes her likable to readers. I was thinking, wow, she's a lot like me. And I have people that I would do anything for, right? And in particular, I was thinking about kind of the arrogance that comes with being sort of the oldest and the caretaker and taking this responsibility on yourself, and how that can lead to you imagining your younger sibling as some kind of a, you know, a perfect fragile thing that needs to be protected. And I was thinking about how much fun that is when you get it wrong, because you always do, because they actually have full personhood. And I love, one of my favorite kind of things is reading a book where the protagonist has forgotten that other people, in fact, have agency. And they're surprised by that. There's such an arrogance to the idea of a protagonist that I really love kind of undermining that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the same as life. We're all the main character in our own lives. We think, you know, everything revolves around us. And then we need reminders every now and again that not everything is about us. So yeah, her interiority and her arc is something that all of us, well, anyone who's self-aware can certainly get on board with. Yeah, their interactions were lovely. And for our listeners, you know, it's so important for your main character to have these kinds of relationships with other characters in the book, because it reveals so much about them. It reveals their vulnerable spots, their soft points. And yeah, just the way they interact with other people is so telling about who they are.
I just think a lot, I've been thinking about this a lot. I listened to an old Sally Rooney interview where she talked about writing socialist fiction. And what she really meant by that was not so much like an economic perspective, but a social one, which is to stop seeing characters and particularly protagonists as individuals, because none of us move through the world kind of alone. We come in networks. We are defined by the people that we are embedded with. And so to start thinking about, I am trying to increasingly see my novels not as like individual heroes' journeys so much as like these fraught networks of people and how they interact.
I love that. Yeah, really, really love that. I need to listen to that interview with Sally. I got to interview her editor for the podcast, which was really interesting to hear about, you know, their interaction there as well. But the socialist outlook, I love that.
Working in a creative industry, I've seen lots of writers and illustrators feel squeamish around money conversations. As a literary agent, I love talking about money, and that's why debunking money conversations are so important. Like, many people think you need loads of money to start investing, or they put off investing because it seems like a later problem. Or creators who deal with art and writing don't have time or passion to research and manage something like investments. That's why I'm thrilled that today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Growing up as a young girl who was told she wasn't good at math, investing definitely scared me. But I'm proud to say that I've overcome all those mindset concerns and love talking about investing and how money can be given a chance to grow over time with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/TSNOTYAW or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important information disclosures at acorns.com/TSNOTYAW. My youngest kid just started kindergarten this fall. I can't believe it. And one of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion is not having French as a foundational language myself. And it's worrying because I need to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're younger now, but I see it coming. We live in a bilingual city of 1 million people. We are so lucky to have multilingual friends and francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up at a young age through school and sports and activities. Me, on the other hand, growing up where French wasn't taken so seriously, I'm going to have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone has been coming into my life. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it truly immerses you in the language that you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio to audio from native speakers, and then gives you feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. You can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages, from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, and even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. It is the best language program to get because they have been the expert in language learning for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. And just in case you were wondering, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel. Rosetta Stone offers Asian languages, while Babbel does not. Rosetta's offer is a lifetime membership, and no other competitor is offering lifetime memberships. Of all the language apps, Rosetta Stone has the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent built into the program. And as you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how you're pronouncing the words. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy a lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys, 50% off. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses that Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off. It's a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Our podcast listeners at The Shit No One Tells You About Writing can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Something you did as well that I haven't seen many people do was using footnotes in a way that sparked curiosity. So for our listeners, there are these footnotes every now and again, and you get it from this, it's a kind of unknown narrator who is contradicting things that the main character is saying or giving some context to it. So it's like an all-knowing character. And it's so effective because it makes us go, who is this person? Why do they know more about the main character than what the main character is prepared to admit about themselves? At one point, Opal says she wrote stories that she never sent out to anybody, and the narrator's like, that's not true. She sent them out and she got rejections. So can we speak a bit, was that always a part of the novel? Was that your plan to include that? Was that something that evolved as you were writing?
Yeah, it was always part of it. I mean, here's the annoying thing. All my novels have footnotes, all my stories as I'm writing them. I think just because it's a habit picked up from like grad school, that's where you put where I got this idea or what I was trying to do there, or like if I had space, I would add in all this extra stuff. And a lot of that is just garbage that needs to be filtered out, and I have to just get it out of my head as I'm going. But one of the great things about this book is I've learned that editors don't love it when you turn in a book with footnotes. I've done it before. And so I took them all out. I turned in Starling House, and then on my edit phone call, my editor was like, it just feels like it's so metatextual. It could have more. It could have, like, you know, bibliography or like footnotes. And I was like, oh, could it? Let me put them back, which is a huge treat. And I love footnotes in fiction. My favorite ever to do it, obviously, is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, but also House of Leaves does it amazingly. And I think they're just such a wonderful opportunity for that kind of adding a layer of narration. You almost get another character that way. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. And again, it sparks that curiosity, and that's what keeps readers turning pages. It's just another level of curiosity in terms of getting them, you know, wondering what the heck is going to happen next. So in this kind of genre, setting up and then maintaining dread and tension is so important. And I look at emerging authors' work often as a creative writing instructor and through the podcast, and we'll see people sort of start off with a bang in terms of tension. But it is so difficult to start off with a bang in terms of tension and then either maintain it or keep heightening it. We tend to see tension leaks. It starts off good and then they aren't able to maintain that. So what's your advice to authors who are working in this space in terms of constantly upping that tension and maintaining that simmering dread throughout?
I should not be asked about pacing. I'm not the person to go to. Because this is the book where I was like, I'm going to finally fix my pacing. Because I have slow fiction in general. I know that, especially in genre spaces. Like, I start off very slow. It's just how I naturally do it. And I was like, I've got it. This time I've really got it. And then I saw someone live tweeting this book very nicely. I want to emphasize that they were being very positive. They were like, wow, I love the book I'm reading, but 90% of it is just a woman cleaning a house. Which is true. That's all that really happens for a good 60% of the book. And I was like, okay, I still don't have it. But I do actually, I am kind of becoming increasingly like defensive of and militant about slow beginnings. And I don't mean slow in terms of like, you're not giving us anything, you know, there's no tension. But I mean like action for me only hits when it's dependent on all the stuff that's been building. And so like to open, I don't know, walking home after a bad shift or something is fine. You're allowed to do that. I think we have perhaps overemphasized this need to like start with the action or skip all the boring stuff, because a lot of the boring stuff is interiority and character and vibes. I love vibes, like get a sense of the aesthetics of a space. And like in some ways, I often think of the first like 5 to 10 pages of a book as introducing your project and your genre. You're telling the reader in that time, like, here's what we're about. So if you create the sense of dread or of ominousness or of doom or gloom, like that's we're going into a gothic, kids. Hold on.
Good point, and I love that. But I do want to emphasize for our listeners, it's not just a case of Opal walking home after a shift, right? Because you can write a character who's walking home after a shift and is like, la, 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 thinking about their shift and thinking about, you know, what they're seeing. I just want to read to you the opening to show you how you can draw a reader in while the character's walking home from a shift. So I dream sometimes about a house I've never seen. I mean, that's the opening line, right? I mean, pretty much nobody has. Logan Caldwell claims he ding-dong ditched the place last summer break, but he's an even bigger liar than me. Boom, we're like, oh, wow, she's a liar and she's admitting she's a liar? Interesting. The truth is you can't really see the house from the road, just the iron teeth of the front gate and the long red lick of the drive. Maybe a glimpse of limestone walls crosshatched by honeysuckle and greenbriars. Even the historical plaque at front is half swallowed by ivy, the letters so slurred with moss and neglect that only the title is still legible, Starling House. And then it goes from there. So we've got excellent writing on a line level. These descriptions drag us in, and I mean, in a paragraph or two, you are hooked. So it's not just a character walking home, Alex, right?
Yeah, you're worried that I'm telling people to do terrible things. No, it's true. It's true. What was funny is when you were reading the like flap cover of the book at the beginning of this, I was realizing, A, how hard cover copy is to write, but B, how 95% of that information needs to be conveyed in the first 5 to 10 pages of the book. Like that's all set up. You just have to be like, you're through that. That's not even the plot of the book. That's telling you what it's going to be.
Yeah, my pet peeve is how publishers give away too much information in the flap copy. And I'm like, this was a reveal on page 80, so why the hell is it there in the flap copy? But yeah, you're right with that. While we were talking about the excellent writing on a line level, I want to read sort of just three short excerpts for our listeners in terms of, because we're always talking about excellent writing on the line level. And I love for them to hear the examples of this. So here we go. We have... Well, nobody ever saw them inside a church. I remain silent until Lacey recalls that I don't go to church either. Mom went before I was born, she said, but once you're on the outside, the only way back in is on your knees. Neither of us ever liked crawling. I mean, that was just a sucker punch of a line, and it tells you so much about the character, the dynamic with her mother, everything about this town. Then we have, listen to this description here. He takes the sword to a large empty room that only ever seems to exist when he's like this, restless and tense, his bones buzzing under his skin. He moves through his drills with a ruthless, graceless efficiency. His mother had been a natural to the sword, as if she had spent her whole life waiting for someone to put a hilt in her hands. She fought like an apocalypse, like a great and inevitable ending. Arthur fights like a butcher, fast and ugly, but still he works until his shoulders shake and his tendons are hot wires under his wrists. Just incredible there. And then over here, I don't mind the walk to Starling House so much anymore. Wearing Arthur's coat is like wearing a small house with shiny buttons for doorknobs and stiff woolen walls to keep out the chill. For the first time, I understand how anybody could actually like winter. It's a delicious defiance to be warm when the world is cold. So, I mean, these are regular things like a coat, and yet you describe it in such an interesting and new way, and it just becomes so vivid in the reader's mind. Are these things, Alex, that you are able to do on first draft so our listeners can hate you more than they already do, considering your journey to publication? Or is this a lot of polishing?
I mean, everything is a lot of polishing, and I don't, when I say I do them on the first draft, it's because I draft very, very slowly. The sentence doesn't come out that way the first time I write it. I'm rewriting as I'm writing constantly. I'm not advertising that as a good system, but it is my system, it appears. I object to the idea, I think, for me, that I could draft quickly and sort of just have an ugly draft and then go back and almost add metaphors like their decoration or something. You know, I don't like the idea that sort of beauty or rhythm in prose is that separate from content. I think they have to come together if they really hit. I liked the ones you picked because they're not just like excessive description. They should be describing like a relationship with a mother or something. You know, like that all has to be coming together. I don't know if you can be like, you know, the way that Goodreads or Storygraph ratings work, where it's like prose versus plot versus things. Like all these things kind of have to be wrapped together, I think.
Yeah. And you know, your process is your process. So for our listeners, there will be some people who race through a draft and then they come back and they really polish it up. For other people, you know, it is slow. It is sitting for a lot of writers. Most of the writing process is not even typing. It's staring at the screen as your mind goes through the words you want to pick and then finally typing out a sentence. And that's fine. We always say your process is your process. Whatever works for you is the way to do it. I've sat with a friend before where we've written together and we'll write for an hour and I'll pound out, you know, 1,000 words and she will have written a paragraph, but oh my God, that paragraph sings like a mofo. It is incredible. And mine is just a big fat mess and I've got to come back and take things out, etc. So I'm kind of envious of that. Last question that we have time for, Alex, is in terms of backstory, in terms of, you know, giving context and exposition, we always say try and withhold backstory as long as you can in terms of building up curiosity. So hint at it, make the reader curious about it. And then when you give it to them, make it feel like a payoff as opposed to upfront, well, this is everything you need to know about this character. This is what happened to their mother. This is, you know, why they are the way they are. So again, what is your advice there in terms of balancing that backstory, but giving the reader enough context up front so that they get on board with the character. And when it comes to withholding information, not withholding it so long that the reader feels manipulated.
I mean, in some ways you're describing like that's the whole ball game. Like if you can figure out what the balance and the pacing of these things are, that is storytelling. So a lot of it is experimentation. And like you realize you've revealed something at the wrong time if it changes nothing. You know, you're like, well, I told you this. And we're just going to proceed with the story. It doesn't change how another character feels about them. It is no realization internally for the main character. You're like, oh, that didn't hit. And you have to change it and put it somewhere else, which is a pain. But I don't know if there's a way around that, if you can foresee everything perfectly. I will say my increasing feeling is that the broad strokes of the backstory should not always be a secret. Because then sometimes it can feel like it's withheld for no real reason. You know, like if there's these huge things in a character's life and it's, you know, like you need to know that Opal's mom died. Why is she living alone in a hotel room with her brother? What's going on here? But it's not like the broad facts that you're withholding. It's kind of the specifics of how it happened and their memory of it and like what it did to them. And to focus kind of down on like a couple of granular details about it that are the little linchpins for them. And those are what's revealed later. That's, I find, what works best for me.
I love that term, the granular details. Definitely. Alex, it's been so wonderful chatting with you. For our listeners, we are linking to Starling House on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get it there, you will support an independent bookstore and you will support the podcast at the same time as this book comes out now in paperback. And we can't wait to see what you come out with next.
Thank you so much. This is a delight.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. We couldn't be more excited to announce that the 1st and 2nd of February 2025 are the dates for the upcoming Deep Dive virtual retreat, which has reverted back to a weekend format so that we can accommodate as many of our listeners across the world as possible. Now, if you love the breakout room sessions and workshops from this year's 10-week Deep Dive, don't worry. We'll still be including sessions like those before and after the 2-day intensive. Plus, this year we're focusing on giving you access to more gatekeepers. So, besides a few awesome author presentations, expect to hear from a lot more incredible agents and editors. This lineup is spectacular. We can't wait to start sharing it with you. Mark the dates in your calendar, especially the date for the early bird pricing, which will happen on the 29th of November. You definitely don't want to miss that. Follow us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter for more details. We hope to see you there.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the 3rd day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.